We're going to begin our lesson today by jumping right into God's Word. So, open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 40. It's straightforward enough, we're not going to spend a great deal of time with this chapter, but we're going to start here. And if you have a complete Jewish Bible, that will be page 44. Genesis chapter 40. We'll read it all. Sometime later it came about that the Egyptian king's cupbearer and baker gave offense to their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh became angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, so he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison in the same place where Joseph was kept. Now the captain of the guard charged Joseph to be with them, and he became their attendant while they remained in prison. Now one night, the two of them, the king of Egypt's cupbearer and his baker, there in prison, both had dreams, each dream with its own meaning. And Joseph came in to them in the morning and saw that they looked sad, and he asked Pharaoh's officers there with him in the prison of his master's house, "Why are you looking so sad today?" And they said to him, "Well, we each had a dream, and there's no one around who can interpret it." And Joseph said to them, "Don't interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please." Then the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. "In my dream, there in front of me was a vine. And the vine had three branches, and the branches budded. Suddenly it began to blossom. Finally, clusters of ripe grapes appeared. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. So I took the grapes, I pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and gave the cup to Pharaoh." Joseph said to him, "Here is the interpretation. Three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office. You will be giving Pharaoh his cup as you used to when you were his cupbearer. But remember me when it all goes well with you. Show me kindness, please. Mention me to Pharaoh so that he'll release me from this prison. For the truth is, I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and here too I've done nothing wrong that would justify putting me in this dungeon." Well, when the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph, "I too saw in my dream. There were three baskets of white bread on my head. In the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds ate them out of the basket on my head." Joseph answered, "Here is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from off of you. He will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off of you." Well, on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he gave a party for all of his officials, and he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his officials. He restored the chief cupbearer back to his position so that he again gave Pharaoh his cup, but he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to him. Nevertheless, the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Well, about 11 years has passed since his older brothers sold Joseph into slavery. So he's 28 years old about now. Now, I wonder if Joseph still thought his dreams of his family bowing down to him that had much to do with his current condition bore any significance, or were they just that, dreams of childhood? Because from where he sat, so long removed from Canaan and from his family, he may well have forgotten about all those sheaves of grain that were bowing down before him, and the sun and the moon and the 11 stars paying homage to him. But let's be very clear about what those dreams meant to Joseph. It meant to him that if these dreams were true, he was going to get the firstborn blessing of his father Jacob, now called Israel. That means that the first 10 of his older brothers were going to be skipped over, and he would become the inheritor of all the wealth and authority of the clan of Israel. So Joseph is sitting in prison because the wife of his master, Potiphar, lied, said he tried to assault her. How long he'd been languishing in prison is difficult to know, but it was long enough that he had gained the trust of the jailer. Then something happened, and Pharaoh became angry with two high government officials, the official cupbearer and the head baker. These were not servant positions, although everybody, by definition, was a servant to Pharaoh. No, these men were likely right in line behind Potiphar in authority. But as is often the case with Orientals, remembering it was Orientals, it was Semites, not Egyptians, that were now ruling Egypt. Some unknown offense winds up costing men their freedom, maybe even their lives. Now, likely as not, the Pharaoh simply was in a bad mood, or unknowingly, as these two officials apparently were Egyptians, they had committed some faux pas of Oriental sensibilities, and these two men wound up arrested. And like Joseph, held in the house of the prison captain, not in the regular prison as with the common folks. After some time, Joseph noticed one morning that both of these men had puzzled and bothered countenances, and he inquired what was troubling them. And they each reported that they had had a dream and they couldn't understand what it meant. It wasn't that these men saw danger in their dreams. It was that in prison there weren't any seers available, no dream interpreters, to tell them the significance of their night visions. Well, dreams were considered to be very important in that era, so there were professional dream interpreters available for a fee. We begin to see the level of faith to which all of Joseph's sufferings had taken him as he responds, "Don't all interpretations belong to God?" And he says, "Tell me your dreams." They proceed. Cupbearer goes first. He speaks of a vine and of three branches and grapes forming on the branches, which he makes into wine for the Pharaoh. Instantly, God gives Joseph the meaning. Joseph tells the cupbearer some good news. Within 3 days, the Pharaoh's going to reinstate the cupbearer to his position. All will be well for him. This seems now to have emboldened the baker, who undoubtedly, as a result of witnessing this great interpretation of the cupbearer's dream, expected equally as good news. The baker, who of course dreamt within the context of his life's experiences, just as the cupbearer had done with his own, saw three baskets of bread on his head, apparently stacked one upon the other. For the uppermost basket attracted birds, which came and ate the baked goods right out of the basket, while still on the baker's head. And Joseph had to tell the baker the bad news that on the same day the cupbearer was going to get restored, the baker was going to lose his life. And of course, that's exactly what happened. One little detail. Many versions say the baker was hung from a tree. That's not really what was said. What actually is said is he would be impaled upon a tree. Hanging was not a typical matter of execution in this era, but beheading was. And often the headless corpse would be impaled on a stake, a tree, as a warning to others. Now, as an interesting aside, Egyptian hieroglyphs prove out many of the details of our story. For instance, the idea of the baskets on top of the baker's head. See, this was exactly the way males carried items in Egypt. They balanced them on their heads. They stacked baskets of bread, the stacked baskets of bread on the baker's head were simply a normal means of conveying the bread from the ovens to the palace, which the baker would have done several times a day. Now, we've all seen this sort of thing on TV travel shows. But here's the thing. You would never see an Egyptian woman put a load on her head. Rather, Egyptian women toted things on their shoulders and on their backs. And this was exactly the opposite from the customary way that Orientals toted loads. So this little insight is just one of many proofs of the authenticity of the biblical narrative of Joseph's and eventually Israel's, their time in Egypt. Well, the last sentence of this chapter is a rather sad one, but so typical of mankind. Joseph, having shown kindness now to the cupbearer, had requested that the cupbearer might do the same for him after he was restored to his position. But we are told that now that everything was back to normal for the cupbearer, he forgot about poor Joseph and left him languishing away for a crime he had not committed. Well, now let's move on to Genesis chapter 41. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, that's page 45. Genesis chapter 41. At the end of 2 years, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing beside the Nile River, and there came up out of the river 7 cows, sleek and fat. They began feeding in the swamp grass. And after them, there came up out of the river 7 more cows, miserable looking and lean. And they stood by the other cows at the edge of the river. Then the miserable looking and lean cows ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. At this point, Pharaoh woke up. But when he went to sleep again and dreamt a second time, 7 full ripe ears of grain grew out of a single stalk, and after them 7 ears thin and blasted by the east wind sprang up, and thin ears swallowed up the 7 full ripe ears, and the Pharaoh woke up and realized it had been a dream. And in the morning he found himself so upset that he summoned all the magicians of Egypt and all of its wise men, and Pharaoh told them his dreams, but no one there could interpret them for him. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, "You know, today reminds me of something wherein I'm at fault. Pharaoh was angry with his officials and put me in the prison of the house of the captain of the guard, me and the chief baker. And one night both I and he had dreams, and each man's dream had its own meaning. And there was with us this young man, a Hebrew, a servant of the captain of the guard. And we told him our dreams, and he interpreted them for us. He interpreted each man's dream individually, and it came about as he interpreted to us. I was restored to my office, he was hanged." And then Pharaoh summoned Joseph. They brought him quickly out of the dungeon. He shaved himself, changed his clothes, and he came into Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. But I've heard it said about you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." And Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It isn't in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer that will set his mind at peace." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Well, in my dream, I stood at the edge of a river, and there came up out of the river 7 cows, fat and sleek, and they began feeding in the swamp grass. And after them, there came up out of the river 7 more cows, poor, miserable looking, lean. I've never seen such bad looking cows in all the land of Egypt. And then the lean and miserable ones," pages of my Bible stuck together, "miserable looking cows ate up the first 7 fat cows. But after they had eaten them up, one couldn't tell that they had eaten them because they were as miserable looking as before. And at this point I woke up, but I dreamed again. I saw 7 full ripe ears of grain growing out of a single stalk, and after them, 7 ears thin and blasted by the east wind sprang up, and the thin ears swallowed up the 7 ripe ears, and I told this to the magicians. None of them could explain this to me." And Yosef said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of the Pharaoh are the same. God has told Pharaoh what he's about to do. The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good ears of grain are 7 years. The dreams are the same. Likewise, the 7 lean and miserable-looking cows that came up after them are 7 years, and also the 7 empty years blasted by the east wind, there will be 7 years of famine. This is what I told Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Here it is. There will be 7 years of abundance throughout the whole land of Egypt, but afterwards there will come 7 years of famine. Egypt will forget all the abundance. The famine will consume the land, and the abundance will not be known in the land because of the famine that will follow, because it will be truly terrible. Why was the dream doubled for Pharaoh? Because the matter has been fixed by God, and God will shortly cause it to happen. Therefore, Pharaoh should look for a man, both discreet and wise, to put in charge of the land of Egypt. Pharaoh should do this. He should appoint supervisors over the land to receive a 20% tax on the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should gather all the food produced during these good years coming up and set aside grain under the supervision of Pharaoh to be used for food in the cities, and they should store it. This will be the land's food supply for the 7 years of famine that will come over the land of Egypt so that the land will not perish as a result of the famine. Well, the proposal seemed good, both to Pharaoh and to all of his officials. And Pharaoh said to his officials, "Can we find anyone else like him? The Spirit of God lives in him." So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there's no one as discerning and as wise as you. You'll be in charge of my household. All my people will be ruled by what you say. Only when I rule from my throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Here, I place you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." And Pharaoh took his signet ring off of his hand. He put it on Joseph's hand, had him clothed in fine linen with a gold chain around his neck, and had him ride in his second best chariot. And they cried before him, "Bow down." Thus he placed him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I, Pharaoh, decree that without your approval, no one is to raise his hand or his foot in all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh called Joseph by his name Zaphnath-Paneah and gave him as his wife Asnat, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Then Joseph went out through all the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Then he left Pharaoh's presence and traveled through all the land of Egypt. And during the 7 years of abundance, the earth brought forth heaps of produce. He collected all the food of these 7 years in the land of Egypt. He stored it in the cities. The food grown in the fields outside each city, he stored in that city. Joseph stored grain in quantities like the sand of the seashore, so much that they stopped counting because it was beyond measure. Now, two sons were born to Joseph before the year of the famine came. Asnat, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. Joseph called the firstborn Manasseh, because God has caused me to forget all the troubles I suffered at the hands of my family. The second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my misfortune. Well, the 7 years of abundance in the land of Egypt ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all lands, but throughout the land of Egypt there was food. And when the whole land of Egypt started feeling the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food, and Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph, do what he tells you to do." The famine was over all the earth, but then Joseph opened up the storehouses and sold food to the Egyptians, since the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all countries came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain because the famine was severe throughout the earth. Now, I told you something earlier that may have caught you a little bit off guard, that at the time of Joseph, Egypt was ruled by Semites, descendants from Shem, son of Noah. That in fact, the Pharaoh of Egypt at the time Joseph was made ruler of the land wasn't an Egyptian. And that during about a 150-year period, official Egyptian government records regarding Egypt's history suddenly ceased. And the reason for this is that kings and pharaohs tended not to write down defeats and times of being subjugated. Understanding this helps for us to understand how Joseph became so powerful, how Israel was at first so free to grow and prosper, but then later how Israel became the brunt of Egypt's rage, and then the Israelites eventually became their slaves. Now, I mentioned that there were several records of that time, however, that were written down, and they were preserved by private Egyptian citizens. And they tell the story about these foreign rulers, these so-called Hyksos rulers. Now, I would like to read you just a very short account as taken from the Egyptian historian Manetho, who lived during the 3rd century B.C., and he compiled several of these records, and he left them for us. Here's what he had to say about this period of time. "We had a king called Ptolemaeus, And in his reign, it happened. I do not know why God was displeased with us. Unexpectedly, from the regions of the east came men of an unknown race. Confident of victory, they marched against our land, and by force, they took it easily without a single battle. And having overpowered our rulers, they burned our cities without compassion. They destroyed the temples of our gods. All the natives were treated with great cruelty, for they slew some. They carried off the wives and children of others into slavery. Finally, they appointed one of themselves as our king. His name was Selytus, and he lived in Memphis, and he made Upper and Lower Egypt pay tribute to him. And when he found a city in the province of Sais, which suited his purpose, it lay east of the Bubasite branch of the Nile and was called Avaris. He rebuilt it. He made it very strong by erecting walls and installing a force of 240,000 men to hold it. Selytus went there every summer, partly to collect his corn and pay men their wages, partly to train his armed troops and terrify foreigners. Here we have a very emotional, very condensed recounting of the conquering of Egypt by the Semites from Asia. We even have the name, an Arabic name, of the conquering king, Selytus. I mean, how it must have stuck in the craw of the Egyptian people to be overrun so easily, so swiftly by these, to their minds, uncivilized hordes. Yet in God's unfathomable divine providence, this is what would set the stage for Joseph to assume a powerful position and for Israel to be held hostage in Egypt for over four centuries. Now, I would like you to take note of a name that I just read that's mentioned by Manetho, Avaris. Because as we study Exodus next, we shall spend some time talking about this particular city. Avaris is the large city that became home to the Hebrews, to the Israelites, in the land of Goshen in Egypt. The very place most secular archaeologists say doesn't exist. A place where an enormous population of Hebrews existed after Joseph's time. And note what a large place it was that this Selytus, this new foreign pharaoh, stationed almost a quarter of a million troops there just to secure it. One last thing. A little earlier, I used some terms, Bedouin, Semite, and Oriental, kind of interchangeably. I want to explain it. The overall continental landmass that contains what we today call the Middle East is Asia. So it's proper to call people who hail from the Middle East, then as now, Asians or Asiatics, people of Asia. Orientals refer not to people from the entire continent of Asia, but to Middle Easterners and people extending as far as China. Orientals are a subgroup of Asians. Semites are people who descended from Shem, and descendants from Abraham are Semites, because Abraham was a Semite. Therefore, Arabs and Hebrews are both Semitic peoples. Bedouins were a certain branch of Semitic peoples that tended to be desert dwellers and wanderers. So it's proper to say that the people who invaded and conquered Egypt were Bedouins, because they were desert dwellers, and Semites, because they were descendants of Shem, and Orientals, because they were part of Middle Eastern culture, and Asians or Asiatics, because they were from the continent of Asia. So all these things properly apply. Well, let's continue now with our study in Genesis 41. 2 years pass from the end of the previous chapter. Joseph is about 30 years old now. Prison still is home. Dreams have so far been nothing but trouble for Joseph. But now that's all about to change. The Pharaoh has two dreams. They're very disturbing to him. Why so disturbing? Because they seem so real that after he awoke, verse 7 says he was relieved to realize they were just dreams. Yet the content was such that they seemed more than a dream, more like a vision. So he felt he must pursue the meaning. He calls all of his magicians, his wise men, to tell him the meaning of these dreams. And these two groups of men the Pharaoh summoned were his brain trust, his governmental cabinet. And they represented the spiritual and the intellectual elite of Egypt. And they were stymied. The religion of Egypt, the spiritual, consisted of much magic and sorcery to go along with the many gods and goddesses. The Pharaoh, as all of his subjects, believed strongly in the ancient mystery Babylon-styled religion of Egypt, so it was just an integral part of everyday life. Christians could learn a lot from the unwavering commitment that these pagans had to their religion, even though it was false, because they considered it the center of their lives. Every facet of their existence was tied to their belief system, unaware that it was a counterfeit system designed by Satan. So the Pharaoh naturally had these experts in religion, these spiritualists, as part of his group of close advisors. Now, conversely, these wise men were not representatives of the spiritual. They were the Egyptian intellectuals. They represented the worldly knowledge, the science that had been developed to such a high degree in Egypt. Now, Pharaoh tells these men about his dreams, but they stood silent, having no understanding, no clue as to what they meant. The chief cupbearer, who had been imprisoned by Pharaoh 2 years past, now reluctantly steps forward, and he tells Pharaoh about this Joseph, who accurately interpreted his and the chief baker's dreams, and Pharaoh immediately orders Joseph to be brought before him. Pharaoh tells Joseph he's had these dreams, which his brightest and best couldn't interpret, but that he was told Joseph could. Joseph answers completely truthfully, "It isn't in me." But God will give Pharaoh his answer. And so here stands this Hebrew slave, Joseph, in the company of Pharaoh, and the most admired religious leaders, and the intellectual elite of Egypt, being asked to do what none of them could do. You know why they couldn't? They weren't equipped for it. Since indeed these were prophetic dreams of holy truth given by God to Pharaoh, how could the simple, entirely inadequate employment of worldly knowledge and false, although sincere, religion possibly fathom the meaning of these God-given dreams? It can never be so. But it forever will be that only the children of God, in spiritual union with our Father, can know the truth. And Joseph is about to announce the truth to Pharaoh. First of all, Joseph makes it clear that these dreams are from God. Next, he informs Pharaoh that both of these dreams are concerning the same matter, the coming of a great famine. And the first dream was about cows, 7 very healthy ones, then 7 very sickly ones. And the second dream was about corn, first 7 healthy stalks of corn, then 7 sickly ones. It was important that there were two dreams because one concerned livestock, the other field crops, that is, the two major elements of the food supply that were going to be affected by what was coming. And as is God's way, he does not bring judgment without sufficient warning for those who pay heed to him. So God says he will see to it that there will be 7 wonderfully, unusually abundant years of food growth and harvest before 7 years, not of less than normal production, but of terrible famine. Well, what comes next is wisdom from Joseph about what to do about this coming trial. And of course, the nature of the wisdom is such, we can have no doubt as to its source. It has to be from the Creator. Joseph says in paraphrase, Pharaoh, during the next 7 years, make it a law that all throughout Egypt, 20% of all produce will be stored away for that day, 7 years into the future, when we're going to need it for our lean times. And rather than living especially high during these 7 years of unusual plenty, be wise and use that time to prepare. Now, I suspect that the people weren't too thrilled about this ruling. After all, as they looked around them, my goodness, all they saw was prosperity. The future seemed bright. There wasn't a cloud on the horizon. Why all this negativity? No doubt many saw it as a conspiracy of these detested Hyksos rulers to simply confiscate food from the people, somehow enrich themselves from it. I mean, how difficult it is to believe God instead of our eyes. It's not easy, especially when things are going so well for us in life. But one has to give Pharaoh a lot of credit for taking Joseph seriously. And he acted on it. He didn't just ponder it. I wonder, would we have the faith to do what this heathen Pharaoh was about to do? Would we have the faith to hear from God that a time of terrible tribulation is nearing? And that we need to prepare by putting aside some of our time and our riches and our labors and our interests and ourselves? Could we intentionally deprive ourselves when we were or are in the midst of abundance? When life is good, can we do it by faith, not by what we see with our eyes? Can we do it when the best and brightest minds and our most prestigious religious leaders tell us the future's unknowable, except as they can discern it from their positions of authority? Beloved, I sure hope we can, because we have been told. We are right now in that time of relative abundance and plenty, just before the onset of one of the greatest trials mankind has ever or ever will experience. How do I know this? Because God's revealed it to us. He has shown us in his prophetic word what the signs are to look for, and they have happened, and they're happening. He has told us unequivocally that when Jerusalem is back in the hands of the Jews, that generation will see the coming of the Lord. He has told us that a few months before Jesus once again sets his foot on the Mount of Olives, there will be a time so terrible none of us can possibly comprehend it. He has told us to prepare, just like Joseph told Pharaoh. Prepare by giving over our lives to him. Follow the wisdom that comes from God. Live within our means. Get out of debt. Seek him instead of our personal pleasures. Learn to rely on him. Trusting him, believing him, not what our fleshly senses, our corrupted intellect might tell us. Because those of us in our time who do not prepare will experience devastation many fold more than what Egypt was about to experience. See, it doesn't matter that so many of our religious leaders are blind to all this. It doesn't matter that our academic elite scoff at it. It doesn't matter that our government sees everything in terms of geopolitical realities, and our lawmakers see things in terms of attaining and maintaining their personal power. Because most of our secular and religious leaders are as oblivious to reality as were Pharaoh's wise men and magicians. You see, God has not entrusted the truth to them. He's entrusted the truth to us, his believers, his worshipers. not to the facade of Christian institutions with all their bureaucracies and all their man-made doctrines. It's to his, to the people, his followers, his believers who have been sanctified through the blood of Christ. That's who's been given the truth. For the Pharaoh, the next question was, who's going to make sure all that needs to be done is done? Not going to get his hands dirty. The answer was obvious. The man God chose to deliver the message, he ought to be the one to carry out all the preparations. Joseph. In one of the most unlikely events, the Hebrew slave Joseph is removed from the dungeon and he's appointed the ruler of all Egypt. Joseph goes from the outhouse to the penthouse. And the only higher authority is Pharaoh himself. A ceremony was held so that all of Egypt would know Joseph's position over them. And as part of this ceremony, Pharaoh gave Joseph a new name, Zaphnath-Paneah. The form we have Joseph's name in today seems to be a hybrid Egyptian and Hebrew word. Scholars say it means either God speaks, he lives, or it means the creator and sustainer of life. More recent scholarship draws that into doubt. It would make more sense that this name is purely Egyptian. And indeed, we find that there is a common word used in naming Egyptians, Zaphnath, which was his first name, which means he who is called. The second word of Joseph's name, Paneah, is also fairly identifiable, fairly easily identifiable in the Egyptian language. Aneah is the word, an alternate word, for life in Egypt. So the Egyptian meaning of his name probably was something like, he who is called life. Pretty good. He who is called life. Now, in our day, a name is simply a way to identify a person. But in ancient times, a name was a lot more than that. A name represented a person's reputation. It was a statement of one's character and attributes, very often status in society. So when Joseph went from house slave to prisoner, vizier of Egypt, a new name was necessary, one which reflected the Pharaoh's view of Joseph's high position and purpose. So to seal Joseph's appointment and to make it permanent, and without doubt to achieve Joseph's loyalty, Pharaoh gave to Joseph a wife, Asenath, daughter of a priest. This was no small thing. The priest was of the temple of On, the city of the sun god. And at this time, this temple was built to honor the god Re, later called Atum-Re. Re was the highest Egyptian deity. Later, the city of On, about 7 or 8 miles north of Cairo, would come to be known as Heliopolis, city of the sun. So Joseph married the daughter of the priest of the sun god, Re. Now, once the ceremonies were concluded, Joseph set about traveling throughout Egypt, setting up a system, seeing to it that an enormous amount of grain was saved and it was stored properly. And we're told that the 6 years before the famine were abundant. The biblical term abundant meaning there were 6 years of bumper crops. 6 years pass. It's a year before the onset of the famine. And Joseph now has two sons by his Egyptian wife, the firstborn being Manasseh, the younger being Ephraim. Now, by the way, these are Hebrew names. They're not Egyptian names. However, due to the customs of those days, that remains the same to this day for Hebrews and many other cultures, the mother's nationality and genealogy determine that of the children. So despite their Hebrew names, in that era, these two boys were without question considered as Egyptian children. Now, the foreign mother of an Israeli could renounce her nationality in God's and become a member of Israel. If that happened, then the mother was not considered foreign, despite her genealogy, but now she was Hebrew. That did not happen in this case. Asenath, mother of Joseph's children, was an Egyptian, and there's no evidence that she gave up her Egyptianness. In fact, it would have been unthinkable, because she was the daughter of the sun god's high priest. She was a princess of Egypt. That she would become a Hebrew? Forget it. Now, tuck this important fact about Asenath, Manasseh, and Ephraim away in your memories. We've talked about this in a number of ways before. But remember, these two grandchildren that Jacob is not even aware he has, Ephraim and Manasseh, these two children of Joseph, born of his Egyptian wife, are by all accounts Egyptians, Gentiles. Notice also that the Torah is clear on two important points in verses 51 and 52. First of all, Ephraim means fertile or fruitful in the sense of abundant. We'll see this carry over eventually into Jacob's prophetic blessing of Ephraim later on in Genesis. But also note that Joseph in no way viewed Egypt as an enemy. Rather, he sees Egypt as a friend, even a place of comfort and sanctuary. He even refers to it as a sort of replacement home. So while we'll eventually see the Hebrews become Egyptian slaves, we're also going to find in the Bible a certain favor of God towards Egypt, especially in the last days of the last days. Well, the famine hits, just as God said it would. But we're also told something here that's often overlooked. The famine was widespread. Now, many Bibles say that the famine was severe throughout the world. But that's not really what the Hebrew says. It says that the famine spread over the panim of Eretz. That means over the face of the land. That's what it says. The panim of the Eretz. This term is a very general term. It's not one that it seeks to indicate all the land masses, known and unknown, of the entire planet Earth. However, as we're going to soon find out in a little while, not just Egypt, but the whole of the Middle East, for the most part, was also affected by this famine. And notice how the distribution of the stored grain occurred. It was rationed or sold. The grain was not given away. Egyptian records of that time describing this famine and how the grain distribution was handled have been found. And they completely validate the biblical record, which we will shortly encounter. What we know is that as people ran out of money, they gave up their starving cattle to Pharaoh in exchange for grain, the staple food. But when they ran out of cattle, they gave up their land. And when they had nothing else to sell, they sold themselves into bond servitude to the Pharaoh. In this way, Pharaoh eventually owned all the land and all the wealth of Egypt. It also allowed him to build up this enormous slave class workforce to construct magnificent temples and roadways and cities and canals and all sorts of amazing things. Now, as cynical and hard-hearted as all this was, God used the situation to save lives and to assure the survival of Israel. One final thought, we'll move on. I wonder what the Egyptian people thought of Joseph during this time of famine. You suppose he got thanked for forcing them to save up grain, doing less during a time of plenty, thereby allowing them to survive later on? Or did he get the blame? Did he receive their hatred when so many had to sell themselves into slavery just to obtain that grain that they'd grown? After all, Pharaoh had made Joseph the front man. Joseph was the supreme administrator of this program. And as we saw, the Pharaoh had a large public ceremony just to make clear, it's this Joseph guy for you to look at. This was a smart dude. All cunning politicians put someone between them and the people to act both as a buffer and as a lightning rod. When things go well, that politician, man, he jumps to the front to accept all the credit and adoration of the people. But when something goes wrong, or it's unpopular, the politician goes silent. He gets invisible real fast. And that front man catches all the flack. Something tells me that the leftover bitterness from this event surrounding the confiscation of grain from the Egyptian people's own private land, and then the selling of it, what should have been their own grain, back to them, often at the cost of their own personal freedom, had a lot to do with how things would pan out a little while later. For it was after Joseph died, and new pharaohs were now in place, and Joseph's family, the Hebrews, had grown huge and prospered, that's when the dispossessed people of Egypt turned on them. Matters like this famine situation are not easily forgotten, and it's unthinkable that this didn't have much to do with Egypt eventually turning the tables on Joseph's family by enslaving them. We will get into chapter 42 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.